Then I started wondering why there was such a big gap. It's like we go from Opium War and then suddenly the rise of Mao. And there must be this big gap of history that was missing. And so then I started realizing that like the most powerful questions aren't really the ones that really demand an answer, but really demand a presence. When I sat with a survivor in like 2015 and I was interviewing her about what was happening and asked, what did it feel like to be forgotten, like a forgotten part of history, even though your story happened? And I feel like that question itself really became somewhat kind of a bridge for them, for their healing also, before they even answer my questions.
After that clip, you know the rest is going to be good. The weekly Substack curated questions dispatch is now live. You can sign up on either Substack or from the Curated Questions homepage. Please take 2 seconds to click the follow or subscribe button on your podcast player. You can set it once and forget tracking down each weekly episode. This makes your life easier and signals to the algorithms that the show should be recommended to other listeners. A simple act that can have an outsized positive impact on others. Now, let's get to it. Albert Einstein said, "Don't think about why you question, simply don't stop questioning." Welcome to Curated Questions. I am your host, Ken Woodward. And these questions are not mathematical equations, but rather a resource to encounter personal reflection and growth. As Tupac Shakur stated, even the genius asks questions. Now, let's engage the questioning community. Greetings, Ken Woodward here. Welcome back to another episode of Curated Questions. Together, we engage inquisitive humans about how they use questions to navigate and make sense of our world. I am a fellow traveler and pilgrim on this journey, and I'm glad you are here. Greetings, Ken Woodward here. Welcome back to another episode of Curated Questions. Together, we engage inquisitive humans about how they use questions to navigate and make sense of our world. I am a fellow traveler and pilgrim on this journey, and I'm glad you're here. Today's conversation is with Jenny Chan. Jenny is the founder and director of Pacific Atrocities Education, which explores the often hidden or shunned actions that occurred during the Pacific-Asian War, the time period beginning with the Sino-Japanese War on July 7, 1937, through the end of World War II. Jenny is committed to uncovering overlooked parts of world history by scanning over 1 million pages at the National Archives and writing books about forgotten Chinese comfort women, Unit 731, and Hong Kong's World War II occupation. She has seen firsthand how raising questions about these suppressed stories encourages critical thinking and empathy. The subject matter is difficult, but delving into history is not restricted to glory. It is important to encounter all the lives and stories that make up our shared history. Jenny, welcome to Curated Questions.
Thank you for having me.
It is a joy to have you here. I thank you for coming on and appreciate the work that you're doing. And I look forward to being able to delve into a little bit of that, or a lot of that, actually. I always like to start at the same point, and that is to say, when did you first understand the power of questions?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I have a very long answer to that. I hope you don't mind.
So I am good.
Yeah. When my grandma passed away, we found this box of like items of military yen and of like rice rationing coupons. And I was wondering like, oh, what are these things? And I had a lot of questions because growing up, my grandma was very upset about Japanese. Like if I'm watching anime, she'll get upset. She wouldn't get upset if I'm watching like Winnie the Pooh, but she's like upset if I'm watching like Japanese anime. One time she even came to our house and like threw away my whole box of manga that I like saved up to buy. And so with those, with her World War II belongings, it started raising a lot of questions in my mind. And I started getting curious, and I was reading I had a very boring job. So I started reading about World War II in Asia, like the Rape of Nanking and also The Rising Sun by John Toland. And I had more and more questions. And then I was reading The Death Factory. And I was thinking like, wow, why is the narrative so different than what I was learning in school, per se? And then I started questioning the narrative of what we have been learning in terms of history and in terms of World War II, and how many stories are not told because of the narrative, and why was the narrative formed like that? And so that's when I started having a lot of questions. And when I started interviewing like survivor, like of World War II, I started also having questions like, what happened and why was this really hidden? And if you think about it, in the West, we learn about China from like, we learn about Opium War. And then there's like a big gap, that at least that's how I learned history, my world history class anyway. And then there's a big gap, and then there's the rise of Mao. And then I started wondering why there was such a big gap. It's like we go from Opium War and then suddenly the rise of Mao. And there must be this big gap of history that was missing. And so then I started realizing that like the most powerful questions aren't really the ones that like really demand an answer, but really like demand a presence. If, for example, when I sat with a survivor in like 2015 and I was interviewing her about like what was happening, it felt like, and asked like, what did it feel like to be forgotten? Like a forgotten part of history, even though that, you know, your story happened, what happened to her really happened. And I feel like that question itself really became somewhat kind of a bridge for them, for their healing also, before they even answer my questions.
Appreciate your answer in that there's very much a story arc. And so you're Chinese, or your heritage. Okay, got it. And then in how your grandmother, just her response, her visceral response to all things Japanese. I just think of how being a kid, and you, like you said, right, you've got anime, you've got all these different things, and it's like, what the heck is going on? So I'm assuming that was happening all during along your childhood, and then it was after her passing,
yes,
that's when your investigation kind of kicked in. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So what was that unpacking of the understanding of why she was, sorry, I'm really screwing up this question here. So what was it like, somebody kind of breaking down a door when it clicked for you that, oh, wait a second, she has all of this history. That's why she was having this visceral response.
Yes.
Is that kind of how it happened for you when you were engaging with this question?
Yes, I think so. And that's when the moment of like, oh, I see why my grandma was so upset, because when we found this box of like military yen, I had realized that, and I Googled it, I was trying to find out what it was. And at that point, I realized that her family probably turned in a lot of their money into this military yen that was worth nothing. And the reason why she kept it for decades is probably she was clinging onto this kind of hope that one day she can go cash it in. And and I have to wonder, because she was younger during World War II, like what that kind of situation had led her to, like had led her to survive, per se.
Yeah, there's definitely some questions to unpack at that point. So I can understand an element of your passion for pursuing these questions. Now, those kind of breakthrough moments, because your investigation has gone far beyond just, oh, let me go read a couple books.
Right.
Right. So it's gone, you've taken this investigation and this inquiry very deep. And so how is this question or inquiry transition from just that to a real passion to understanding and unearthing.
Yeah.
There's definitely been a shift.
Yeah. When I realized that when I was reading these books and also like going through what Occupy Hong Kong meant, I realized that like when I was learning about World War II in high school, per se, right? It's like we learned about Pearl Harbor, and like 8 hours after Pearl Harbor, it's like the attack of Hong Kong. So apparently the war that my grandma suffered in is the same war as Pearl Harbor, that moment led me to realize that when you learn history, it's not really just incidents. It's like it leads to bigger part of things. And then when I was reading about how the lower estimate of Pacific Asia War is like 30 million people, then I'm like thinking like, wow, if the Rape of Nanking is only 300,000 people, that's a drop in the bucket. That's not even a fraction of 30 million people. And I started having a lot of questions, like what happened in between the Rape of Nanking and also like Pearl Harbor? And then what happened like between Pearl Harbor and the end of the war? Because we don't really learn too much about it. And I think that, I don't know about anyone else, but we learn mostly of like Hitler and the Holocaust. And in most of our like high school education. And like, I still remember that one of my friends in history class was then like blurbing out how the Japanese were bayoneting kids and whatever. And like, our teacher didn't really know what to say to that. And so I felt like there was this gap. And so then I started having more questions. And that's really what got me into really delving in. And also after reading all these books and then after realizing these figures, and like so many stories that were just kind of forgotten, I was looking for a job that would like maybe be related to researching about World War II in Asia, given so there are so many Holocaust centers and there are so many World War II that's so Western based. And I couldn't find anything really about a nonprofit that's centered on like researching World War II in Asia. And I think that's what got me started in this whole journey. And I was way more naive back then into thinking that like, oh, I can raise money, I can start an organization, I can document a lot more of these like stories that had happened. And yeah, I think I did it at a really good time though, because a lot of the survivors that I talked to in 2015, they're no longer with us. Yeah.
Those conversations, let's talk about those conversations a little bit, because you're now talking with folks that have lived with this trauma and managed it in some, however they chose to manage it, or however they figured that out. How did you use questions? You had mentioned one question previously, but how did you use questions to engage with them on such a brutal topic?
Yeah, it's not easy, I have to say. It was not easy for me either. I had a lot of questions, especially about like these comfort women who were living in China at the time, in Shanxi, and they basically survived like rape daily by the Japanese soldiers. And this is a part of China I've never been to. I have to say that I had a lot of questions, and I realized that it's not comfortable to ask these questions. And I sat with them for a while before I even started asking questions. And I think a way for people to answer questions, especially if they don't know you too well, is to actually get to know you. And it was very unsettling in a way that when they started talking about their experience in wartime Japan, China, and they were telling, there was this story that still stuck with me to this day. And it just started having, I had more questions afterward, because it's just like, it's not that they only suffered during the war, they also suffered after the war, if you think about it. And this woman had like a baby after being tortured by the Japanese soldiers. And like for so long, because they were, she was brutally raped. And afterward, she had to hide about what had happened to her. And so she was pregnant after the war. And her mom told her to like bury the baby at somewhere that she didn't. So then just kept it a secret. And I think that's kind of the power of questions. We get to start inquiring about, you know, not just asking about like, hey, what had happened to you over the war, but also like your experience through it, right? And also your experience after, what is, you know, your whole experience. And I think sometimes that just demands the presence of someone else being there and asking that kind of question, but not like in terms of like inquiring and being like, hey, and then what happened and blah, blah, blah. It also requires listening, and it also requires an amount of presence being there.
I kind of shudder to think about the size of container that you have to be as far as being able to hold space for that, because I can only imagine that some of these survivors really hadn't, this has been something that's either been tamped down or they've, you know, it's kind of a box or, you know, a jar that they've kept closed for a long time. And so for you to be a person that, A, you've built trust with them enough that they're willing to share, right? And then for them to share the stories, and now it's out, right? It's a presence in the room, in the space between.
I also think that before someone dies, they also really want to tell their life stories.
Mm.
And that adds to a part of why 2015 was like a turning point, because a lot of those survivors were already passing away, or they're on the way of, you know, no longer being with us. And some of it is that they wanted to tell those stories before they pass away, so then, you know, someone knows. And our colleague also did a interview in like the Central Coast, and there were a lot of Filipinas there who fought in World War II, but they kind of just never talked about it afterward. And they immigrated to the United States, and they were living their, you know, their stable lives. And even their kids didn't know that they fought in World War II. And and I think, you know, just being there and asking questions, Stacy, my colleague, was able to really dive into the legacy that even their children didn't know about.
Just kind of resonates with me on the idea that as folks get a little bit older, in that there is a desire to kind of share.
There was this 91-year-old guy who was working as like a Unit 731 worker. Like this is, he must have been working there as a teenager, as a youth corps member. And he like wants to talk about his story, about how, because Unit 731 was like a biological weapons lab, and they were doing all kinds of human experimentation. And he felt this like inner guilt, even though that he's only worked there at the end of the war. And as a teenager, he didn't know what he was doing. And because all the adult men were fighting the war. And so he started talking to like, to the press and to whoever that he can find, and just talking about the story that, you know, and what he had witnessed. And his children and his wife told him to stop because they don't want to be ostracized by other people, by him telling all these stories. Yeah, which is another like unfortunate thing about, I think, why so many of these stories are kind of covered up, because, or just not told, because of people feeling ashamed. And in the wartime, that's not what normal people do. And so after that, they just don't want to talk about that again, or they feel this emotion that they need to lash out, just like how my grandma used to lash out with like anime and whatnot. And so, yeah.
You mentioned the comfort women. So can you just give a definition or kind of a breakdown on what that actually means?
Yeah, comfort women was basically like a system to keep the Japanese soldiers happy, because wherever they were invading, they would then start raping women and getting STDs. And it started getting out of hand that they established a system called comfort stations. So then it's like with a physician, and it's more of a controlled environment, and they would kidnap local women to be in this comfort station. Most of them are like, you know, so then they're not just raping. So then the soldiers are not just raping women on the street, and they kind of institutionalized it into a comfort station. So that's what I meant by comfort women. And Unit 731 was basically this covert biological lab that was started by Ishishiro. And it's basically like he knew that the West was signing a Geneva Convention, and he thought that, well, if germs are so powerful, I need to harness it. And so then in order for Japan to become a world power, so he established Unit 731. But it's not easy. This is not like a rogue individual. It's not easy to like start a biological lab with no money. So he knew that in Russo-Japanese War, the Japanese soldiers were falling because of the lack of clean water. And the emperor was like this hobbyist biologist. And so he made this water filter, he peed into it, and then he drank this filter pee in front of the emperor. And the emperor was so impressed that he was given funding right away. And then he was able to start this human experimentation lab to like see effect of like anthrax, glanders, and the plague, and like develop also like these flea bombs. At first he had it in Tokyo, but then he thought, well, if I do it so openly in Japan, in the capital, people are going to find out. And so what happened was that he then moved the lab when Japan conquered Manchuria, which is 10 years before Pearl Harbor in 1931. He decided to move the lab to Manchuria because it's probably going to be more remote and lesser known. And what's interesting is that but he was still found out, because one day during like his security guards were celebrating and security was loose. And so then like his human experimentation, like people just ran away. And then he moved to another site. He moved to like a whole village, and then he took over like these buildings, and then he basically evicted everyone out of this village and established like a lot of buildings and like human experimentation like site. And then on top of that, he had a experimentation like field called anti-testing ground, where he was testing these like weapons that he was making with like ceramic flea bombs per se, and also with like bombs with anthrax and also glanders in it, so that like he can just harness the power of germs. And and then there were also like experiments where he was trying to test like the G-force to see how much like pilots can take in terms of like airplanes G-force. So yeah, that was Unit 731.
Wow, that is just brutal. What did it look like post-war as far as prosecutions go? Is that something that was taken very seriously? I mean, what did all that look like?
Yeah, so that's a great question. In post-war, immunity was, I think, more of a victor justice. So they prosecuted folks who, you know, planned Pearl Harbor per se. But for Unit 731, they actually sent investigators, and they figured out that the science behind Unit 731 was so great. And it's these are things that you cannot produce post-war and at a peaceful time. So they sent like three scientists also from Fort Detrick, and they decided to basically just buy the result from these scientists. So Ishishiro pretended that he died, but then the CIA also still found him somehow. And then they negotiated a deal where the US would buy this kind of research from Ishishiro and also his scientists. But there was also Operation August Storm. So the Soviets went into Manchuria and actually captured a few of the scientists. And then they went to trial. But then that was dismissed by the West of being like communist propaganda. But at the end of the day, those scientists were still released in like 1950s and whatnot. And most of the scientists from Unit 731 actually lived like very prosperously after the war. Ishishiro died of like very healthy, actually he died from like lung cancer. His right hand man, I will call him, died. Well, he was a CEO at Green Cross Pharmaceutical. And then a few other scientists, I can't remember the name off of my head, became like mayor or like politicians. And so then no one really faced justice, I wouldn't say.
That's just mind-blowing to hear how this was handled between the prosecution and all of the propaganda that's come out.
Actually, now I think about it, especially with these like post-war narratives and how US really needed Japan to fight China because communism was so evil. And now I look at this war, I'm like, maybe we need to question the narrative a little bit more. I started having a lot of questions, especially like when I compare that with like the atrocities from World War II and then how they were not having like justice per se, right? Like, then I started using questions to like kind of really lower the threshold of like wonder. So like instead of asking how humans can actually do this, I started asking like what are some of the like small daily choices that led to this kind of behavior, right? And I think it makes this kind of less scary and more understandable as like a human process. And the way that they were able to capture other humans to use them as logs, or they call them as logs or maruta, so then they can be less human, so then they can do that too. They can capture other human beings and open them with vivisection and open them. And it was very jarring for me to see like that in person as well. I went to the Unit 731 Museum where they had like two incinerators, where they even had like so there were scientists who also died from doing experimentation like incorrectly. So then sometimes germs backfire and then they die at Unit 731. And then there were also the victims. And there were two incinerators for the Japanese and also for the victims that die at Unit 731. And I realized that because they need to separate themselves from their victims, they don't see themselves as the same class of human as their victims. And it goes back to like Kishi Nobusuke, who was actually allegedly a class A war criminal. He came up with a lot of the wartime economic policy in Japan occupied Manchuria. But then after the war, Eisenhower actually called him his biggest bet. Eisenhower got him out of Sugamo prison, and then he was scot-free. He became prime minister of Japan within like 10 years from a war criminal. And then his grandson, I'm pretty sure you have heard of his grandson's name, Shinzo Abe. That was his grandson who was assassinated in recent history. And what he wrote in like his diary and also like what he was writing in terms of like all these like policy, he even wrote that, like, you know, Chinese people are like toilet water and Japanese people are like pure water. We cannot mix the Japanese with the Chinese. And that is also, you know, the same kind of thinking when Hitler was able to have the Holocaust. You think the other humans as lesser. And like, you know, nowadays on the media, I feel like we are able to call certain population terrorists so quickly. So then we can feel that another person is like lesser than. And so then we can have start drafting this narrative. So then it starts getting into a very scary part of like human psychology, where we can then look at like things like, okay, so if these people are lesser than, then it's okay for us to go and bomb them and kill them, and then we need to condemn their behavior.
Yeah, it is so rampant in today's world for us to quickly other or make others of people that we do want to segment as different than who we are. It is quick, you know, that we hear that folks are labeled terrorists, or the, you know, like with everything that's been happening with this now war in Iran, it's, yes, we're going to quickly call everybody a terrorist. It's like, it's, A, I think that it's important to really be careful of who we're labeling what, just because it's so easy to do and fear is so cheap, but it is easy to just throw a label on someone.
Yeah, and I also think that I like social media, but at the same point, like, I think social media is allowing a lot of people to hide behind like their username. And then they say things that are really nasty. If they say it in like a civilized society, people just look at them like, oh, that's crazy. But then like, because they can hide behind a keyboard, they can start saying things that are really, you know, not that great. For example, I can't imagine being Jewish and being on social media today, even. And like, it's just a whole wide of cast of net being on like everyone. And like, and also like, I can't imagine being like Muslim being on social media today, because then they're like, oh, this group of people are all terrorists. But then like, I started reading into it, I started questioning that narrative, and I'm like, wow, they're the Muslim type, like, population is actually very diverse. Like, there are all kinds of like Muslims out there, and it's just interesting. So I think like the power of question, like, people need to start questioning the narrative. People need to start questioning like why people's behavior, and also like take a step back to like look at it at a more smaller and like less, a more understandable kind of process, if that makes sense.
It does. It does. And yeah, that ability to make others the other.
Yeah. Yeah. I think how people can get to like the point of genocide, and I've been thinking about that a lot, is to blanket statement the whole group of people and to say that these people are like that. And versus like, you know, I don't think certain, like, we should put a blanket statement on everyone, because that's when they start dehumanizing, and that's when really the value of life is in the darkest point, can be traded for scientific data as human experimentation.
Yeah. Yeah, I completely agree. And it's just so radical and unfortunate at how quickly exactly we bucketize people into these bins just to make them the other.
And it's so sickening, because I feel like I watched this crazy video of like an IDF soldier shooting a child who was just throwing stones at him. And it was unsettling. I felt like if my home was being destroyed, like that child's home, I would probably be throwing stones too.
Yeah, that's one of the things that's been really super painful for me, is just seeing what's been happening and the dehumanization of the Palestinian people and the dehumanizing language that the Israeli, certainly the politicians, are using to describe the individuals, or, you know, the Palestinian indigenous, at this point anyway, the Palestinian folks in specifically Gaza, and then kind of the apartheid that happens across the West Bank as well.
Yeah, we just did an episode about that. Like, we fought for independence, but when the Philippines were trying to fight the Spain with for independence, at first U.S. had like a Spain war, and then the U.S. negotiated with Spain at the Treaty of Paris for Philippines for 20 million. And we, as Americans, we say that we like freedom, but we deny Philippines for having their own freedom. More Philippines died fighting for their freedom. 400,000 Filipinos died fighting for freedom. Then more Filipinos died fighting for freedom than Americans died fighting D-Day, if you think about it. And it is so sickening to me that, like, at one point, and just watching, like, Hexav saying, I know I'm not supposed to get into political, how these are the bad guys and we need money to fight the bad guys. When you see it on TV, even with such censored, like, content, I feel like Americans are the bad guys here. In a way, like, we're funding a lot of certain way to, like, kill people. And it doesn't, I don't know about you, but, like, right now it's tax season and I'm not feeling good about having to pay taxes to contribute to this kind of, I would call it genocide. And I mean, it's just, it's really sickening if you think about it. And the most sickening thing is that, like, there's really nothing we could do. What can we do?
It's crazy thinking about the kid or the Palestinian child throwing a rock at the idea of soldiers. And I think about how we as Americans are always siding with the rebel. In Star Wars, we would have been the rebels, right? And you just think of any of these different movies. Because as we go back to our independence, right, it was all about us being the rebels and us pushing back and us fighting. And then when it comes to now where we're at as a power, I kind of question if we've now switched sides and now we are the bad guys. And I just think that there's a cognitive dissonance in the ability for us to always see ourselves as the underdog when we have all of this capability and all of these assets. And just kind of reflect back on any of these periods of time where a group is fighting, you know, the greater powers to save their land or to be able to remain indigenous to their land and not to be colonized. It's just crazy at how the arc has kind of flowed over time and how we as Americans have seen ourselves and kind of view ourselves through these different periods of time. It's crazy.
They need another $20 billion. And, you know, we're already crossing $39 trillion debt. What do you think is going to be like the future of most empires end when there's a lack of money?
Yes, it's something that I think about more so now than probably ever before. In just thinking about how my tax dollars are being used for this kind of empire building and the influence elsewhere, it's definitely struggle with what that looks like. And I'd rather there be more options other than just waiting until the next election. So yeah, it is definitely a struggle for what are those tangible or kind of concrete actions that we actually can do. Yeah, struggle with that myself.
Yeah, Qing Dynasty. Qing Dynasty ended at about 280 years, I think. Like, and right before they ended, they had this kind of thing, which is what Elon Musk was doing with Doge, where I forget his name, but like a bureaucrat was trying to reform the government. And then he had no success. It lasted for 100 days, kind of like how long Doge lasted. And then there was corruption. There were never-ending wars. And that's how the Qing Dynasty folded.
Yeah, I mean, the scary thing is that historically it's been like, you know, countries will be around for like 250 years. 250 is like a threshold for progress and being able to sustain sustain itself and carry on. And we're like, this is year 250. So the fact that it falls like right on it is pretty darn scary.
Yeah, actually, when I post about something, I think it was like about comfort women, there were some people who were just like, oh, I thought these were just like high paid prostitutes in wartime and whatnot. And then there are also people who ask, like, why can't we just move on? And I think those are really questions that close the loop and don't really spark really curiosity, or like they're trying to close a loop so then people don't ask any more questions, right? And I think those are the people, those are the kind of ineffective questions or questions that really should not be really asked, because then we are forgetting that those people's stories actually mattered and what happened to them was actually real.
Indeed, we've got some crazy days ahead of us, that is for sure. Shifting a little bit into the world of how do you think that we should be using questions, or what do you think might be ineffective questions that people are applying to looking at history and evaluating the current days, but then also as we look back and review,
I think,
what life has looked like and through the lens of some of these atrocities. How do you see that kind of coming together?
I think today our geopolitical world is not like policies wise. They don't happen just because of something, like just be out of the blue. I think a lot of the parts of the world have historical memory. They have historical trauma. Like, China is not going to forget what had happened to them when they were facing like what they call a century of humility. They were being invaded by foreign forces, and that's why they need to rebuild their military, and that's why they kind of need to be strong. And like South Korea is not going to forget. I think even North Korea is not going to forget the days that they were colonized by Japan. And Japan is never going to forget how atomic bomb happened to them either after the war. And so by understanding these stories and what had happened during the war, we actually can understand better our current day geopolitical situation and the context of why countries make the decisions that they do.
So how are you seeing your role as you kind of become the caretaker of the stories for so many? And then beyond just being the caretaker and the one that's carrying these, you've also got to have a massive amount of empathy, or just the ability to hold all these stories at one point. To me, it just seems like that's got to be quite the challenge. But so how do you envision your role, if you will, in doing all of this research and diving into this history?
Yeah, I think that I used to have a harder time, but now I really feel like it's kind of my life purpose to bring these stories to life. And also it helps build empathy in this world. I think it's and it's also very empowering to see that, for example, I work with the survivor from World War II, and she had never talked about her life experience in China for decades. She was a young kid, and she was she lost her brother due to like starvation at the time. And like, you know, talking about Palestinian and starvation and earlier. And she would never like, she told me that after the war, she moved on. She was later like a mathematic professor in Sonoma State University. And she didn't want to talk about it anymore. It wasn't until like her late husband brought her to watch a World War II movie. And she was crying so hard that like her late husband had to carry her to the car. And when we first started the organization, she was really, she reached out to me and she was really such a supportive person. And I had no idea that she survived the war. She had mentioned it at the time. And then we were doing a lecture and I was asking her like with the Day of Learning with the Holocaust Center. And I was like, oh, do you want to come by and do your lecture? And she was like, oh yeah, sure. And like she was telling her experience, and by the end of it, she was crying so hard, I didn't even know what to do. And she's been just telling the story with us, you know, either through our summer internship program or through like last year we had a conference. And she came by and she talked and she dropped like a tear. And I can see that she's healing. And for me, it's really empowering to see, you know, not only are we telling the story, like people who lived through it and can tell their stories are now really also able to heal themselves in a way. And I think that a lot of healing needs to have to do with acknowledging what had happened. And I think it's, and that's how I am, where I've been able to cope, just by like not only focusing on the negativity of it, but also by focusing on how it is that how survivors are actually able to tell their stories. And also like, then we can, and we can maybe prevent it from happening again.
How do you think that we go about memorializing and remembering as well as kind of working that healing process? What do you think that that looks like?
I think we need a lot of empathy, to be honest. And also, if you have a family member lashing out like my grandma was, maybe half a bit more. I regret not having that amount of empathy to ask what had happened. And I think that is a good way to start, you know, so that that way we not only collect our community stories, we can also collect our family stories and, you know, make sure that that what happened to them, the kind of legacy kind of live on for better or for worse.
Well, certainly the, as I reflect back on the learning that I've done going through this country's history and experiencing the lack of willingness for people to fully engage in having this conversation, I'm not probably all that encouraged as far as what that growth might actually look like and how it might be embraced. So generally, I have been kind of optimistic, but on some of these things, as far as us really digging in and understanding our history, it definitely has to be fought for. Looking at what's happened out in Philadelphia, where Trump had told the where they got the Liberty Bell that they needed to take down the display that recounted slavery in America. Now it got fought and it got put back, but that kind of thing, it's just, we just traditionally, and specifically the white community, is not one that's really wanted to have these conversations. So appreciate the work that you're doing. Just don't know.
Yeah.
The folks leaning into it, how much leaning in will actually happen.
And maybe I'm a little bit more optimistic than you. We have had like success in reaching out to young people, and like a group of high school students reached out to us and did a documentary that won National History Day in New Mexico. And like they won first prize. And we also have had like summer interns who now are like professors. And I just hope that they kind of spread this kind of education and also teach empathy and also the effects of atrocities and injustice in the world.
Well, I'm glad that the experience that you're having with specifically the younger set, or kind of the younger group anyway, the high school students and the like, I'm glad that you're seeing interest there and folks are actually leaning forward into it. And I guess it's often said that the young will lead us. So maybe that's what a little bit we're seeing there. And I'm glad that you've got some optimism based on your experience and what you've been seeing. That's great news.
I think me having an open mind is a very important one, because I think I simply didn't listen to my grandma just because it didn't fit in my narrative of what had happened in World War II in my mind. And I think having an open mind and just being able to like listen it, and even though that things may not fit into your narrative of what had happened, is really important.
So what has that experience been like for you in some of the other Asian cultures, or specifically the Japanese culture, in digging into this history? Because it's not good news, right? What does that look like in your experience?
I think that I actually work with a lot of Japanese people who want to tell the truth. For example, I reached out to this guy named Kuroi, and he was telling me that his father fought in the Kwantung Army, who was like occupying Manchuria. And his father came back really nasty and had daily nightmares and was really mean to his mom. And he found pictures of his dad like before the war, and he was a happy guy. And he was telling me how he had longed to meet his dad before he was sent to war. I think that a lot of us, you know, citizens of the world, were kind of, the more I think about it, the more I think that we're kind of enslaved to our government. Like, our government sent us to a war. Like, for example, Mr. Kuroi's father was sent to a war and he accepted it. And then he was fighting for his country. He was accepting orders, right? And so I think, and a lot of Japanese people don't know what had happened during World War II. They learn about the atomic bomb and, you know, they don't learn about the things that happened between 1931 to 1945. I think that until we break that kind of narrative and can tell the stories and like can reflect, and then that way is not a lost thing. And I think that as civilization goes, like, we need to understand each other before, you know, we just drop a nuke. We decide to go drop a nuke on another country. You know, this, the like, current day situation is very scary, because I think that we're past the point of empathy. We're first talking about like ground troops, and we're now talking about nukes, and then there's it's all like we were saying earlier. I think it all starts with language.
I'm tending to think that the more and more we question whatever our ideals are, we're probably going to be on a slippery slope one way or the other on our political standings.
Or at least just understand where they came from, you know, and talking to the son of, you know, the past soldier, it feels a lot more like, okay, the guy was just listening to order, and, you know, and it's not like, and also being like an American per se, right? I think America also goes around the world and does a lot of war crimes. And whenever I travel, people will tell me that, like, I went to Serbia, and like holding an American passport there is not a pretty picture. They remember, you know, during the Cold War, what America was doing, right? And it was like, and this woman was like, oh, you know, I like you because you're Chinese American, but if you were just an American, I would hate you to your gut. And she's my age. She was telling me how she spent her childhood in the bomb shelter and how that had happened because of America. It's heartbreaking, you know, and just viewing how I'm starting to sound like a libertarian. But yeah.
And sadly, America's hands are not clean in how we have inserted ourselves around the world. And so, yeah, I think that there's some recognition that there's some of our own part of the world as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's why we have to be honest about world history. And we should not forget, you know, tragedies that have happened.
So as you started out on this journey,
totally agree.
There's some heavy lifting, right? Heart heavy lifting that actually is that you're doing in this work. And you mentioned earlier kind of a responsibility that you feel kind of called to this work. But what role does curiosity play in this for you? Is it just your own curiosity, or can you kind of peel back that onion a little bit and talk about what that looks like for you?
I think I have to be curious to do the amount of work that I do, because I was just like, for example, when I found this Russian trial, and then I was going down this rabbit hole of like, okay, did the Russians really, is it really a true trial and whatnot? Was what they were releasing, is it really propaganda or is it real? And sometimes you can't dive into that without curiosity. And then like I went down a whole rabbit hole and realized that in the 1970s, then the Soviet Union had a like anthrax leak. And I was thinking, well, in order to have anthrax leak, you need to have some kind of biological lab. So then I realized that maybe there was some merit to this trial, because maybe they also obtained this kind of information from the Unit 731 scientists. So that's one example. And so it's not like I'm pro-Russian or pro-Soviet Union in saying that they were upholding justice. At the same time, if they had taken that information, they could have used it to enrich themselves as well. And then maybe they will send some other soldiers to go and, you know, kill this guy and kill that guy. And it boils down to like what I was saying earlier, that people, you know, listen to their government, maybe a little bit too much. And then also like to go down certain rabbit holes, I think it does require a lot of curiosity into like trying to delve into the past. And I was reading about how the Kwantung Army was starting World War II, like just 10 years before, even 10 years before Pearl Harbor. And I was thinking like, wow, no way. And so I started reading like a bunch of books on trying to get to like, what was the Kwantung Army? What was China like? And there was actually not one single book about the Kwantung Army. So our organization is doing like the first book on, or we actually did it, about Kwantung Army by Quinn Cho, who was a research fellow. And it also sparked from just curiosity and asking questions. And yeah, and I think asking questions are really important part of life.
But you're certainly not going to get any argument from me on my end. So I'm really curious for you in what time feels like for you. And where I'm going with this is that since I was doing all of my study on really kind of the last couple hundred years and tying the pieces together and back to slavery and the steps in between Jim Crow, Reconstruction, and the like, it seemed like time just really collapsed. And it wasn't something where when you say 100 years ago, 100 years ago really didn't feel like that far away. Now, prior to doing all this research, 100 years ago felt like forever. But that time has just really, really collapsed. So how has that worked out for you? Have you had the same kind of sensation on your end?
It does feel like that, especially because then I meet like the son of like certain soldiers. And then like, you know, I hear from the guy who used to work at Unit 731 when he was a teenager. It does feel really recent. right? Even when I read like about Teddy Roosevelt and his take on the colonizing the Philippines, that happened like hundreds of years ago, but it feels very recent. And when I read history too, I feel like it really repeats itself, because like if you think about it, McKinley was assassinated, then Roosevelt took on the presidency, and then he made the quagmire in Philippines. He kind of like expanded that situation. And JFK was assassinated, then Lyndon Johnson became president, and then he also escalated the Vietnam situation. And so I know that out there, a lot of people are hoping that Donald Trump gets assassinated and whatnot. But I'm like, what if J.D. Vance gets even worse? What if it's a repeat of McKinley, Roosevelt, or of like JFK and Johnson, you know? And then it gets really dark.
Right.
So when people are saying that, I'm like, no, you don't know what's going to come. You don't know what's coming.
Yeah, that is absolutely crazy. Now, for the record, I'm not saying I need Trump to get assassinated or anything like that at all. But yeah, I understand the concern, and I see how history can definitely repeat itself. And that can be scary in its own right. That's for sure.
I think questioning the media is also a really big thing. Like, for example, in wartime Japan, there was all kind of propaganda and anime that got people more fired up to fight the war. And can kind of see that today in like our media about Iran, for example. For a while, in like the beginning of the year, oh my God, 2026 feels like it's been so long. But in 2026, in the beginning of it, they kept saying like, we need to overthrow this because of the Iranian revolution. And so then we need to regime change. And so then they can have a democratically elected leader. But they already had a democratic elected leader in like the 1950s. But Teddy Roosevelt's grandson, who was working for the CIA, overthrew that regime. And so then when in 1953, in conjunction with BP, because he was going to nationalize gas and they didn't like that, because then BP would not be able to profit so much if the Iranian democratically secular leader of Iran was able to do that. And so by learning history and questioning the media, I was able to come to the conclusion that this is kind of bullshit from what they were trying to say. And it's also like, then I'm like, man, what is Teddy Roosevelt's grandson did that? So now what is like the Roosevelt family up to? If you think about it, they kind of started a century of drama in Asia by Teddy Roosevelt colonizing Philippines and then helping Japan win the Russo-Japanese War by bringing the Japanese diplomat to fundraise at Wall Street and whatnot. And then Teddy Roosevelt was the one who negotiated and basically handed Korea to Japan. And Korea suffered for like centuries after that. And for decades after that. And so then it really started getting me to question the media. And I think by learning history and not kind of moving on, we can see how the media is playing us.
So we covered a lot of ground on where or how you use questions in your work. What are some other areas that you think that questions could be helpful or perhaps even underutilized?
I question a lot of the headlines that I read, and then I go down the rabbit hole. I ask a lot of questions. For example, if they really focus on like democracy, right? Then, and like Iran, then I'm like, okay, then what had happened in Iran and democracy? How, and then they, I think there was like a while where on social media, there was a trend that was like, oh, this is how Iran looked like before 1976, like revolution. And then I was Googling about like, what is that revolution? And then like, and then I realized that it was the last Shah, but then I realized that the last Shah was not democratically elected. It was kind of installed. And then I worked backward. And that's how I came to the conclusion that they overthrew the democratically elected government in 1953. And a lot of people might think like, oh, 1953 happened so long ago, but like, it still had effects, because then obviously it led to this kind of domino situation where then there was a revolution and then they had their own thing going on. And so then, and then also it comes to this conclusion that if they had messed up doing the first overthrowing of a regime, then should they do it again, per se, right? And I think that's the power of learning history, is that then we can analyze what is happening today as well.
We've covered a lot on the world stage and looking to bring it in a little bit more to the personal level. And I like to ask guests what their right now question is. So this is something beyond what's for dinner and if I'm going to get married and who I'm going to get married to. And this is more about coming to the very present. And so what is your right now question?
I have a lot of questions. Like, how does it look like when the $39 trillion debt is not paid, right? How does that look like for tomorrow or like by the end of this year? What does it mean if the interest rate goes up or if it goes down? If it goes up, does that mean that then the national debt repayment is going to be more than $1 trillion per year? That's a lot of the percentage of our GDP. And talking about GDP, then I start questioning, like, how's the GDP so high? Is it from really like true goods and service? Or is it from like, you know, getting ripped off at my dentist's office? And so those are like a lot of my current questions that I had. And also, what does it mean? Like, if... And I've been looking at like a lot of data in terms of like de-dollarization. And I noticed that like in the last 20 years, like 20% of the countries are now ditching the dollar. And so then, I mean, I'm pretty sure we might suffer if there's de-dollarization, but there's still like half of the world that's attached to the dollar. And so then we might suffer, but then how are other people going to suffer? Are we going to see starvation? Like, and then also the oil prices, I'm like, is it going to come down? Is it going to go up? How are they going to hold oil price like artificially down while the whole block is like, it's like blocked, you know? I'm almost looking at it at the map like a video game, like how do you beat this level?
Fantastic. As we look towards kind of wrapping things up here, where is the best place for folks to track you down and see the things that you're interested in and learn more about your organization?
Yeah, on our website, pacificatrocities.org. And we also have a YouTube channel, Pacific Front Untold.
But Jenny, I want to thank you for the work that you're doing, the empathy that you have, and the space that you're creating for those that are remembering, that we still have with us, and making a difference to them, but also doing the hard research and diving into making these stories available such that we can all learn from history. So I appreciate that. And thank you for coming on and being a part of Curated Questions. I'm grateful to have you here. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Ken here. The weekly Substack Curated Questions Dispatch is now live. You can sign up on either Substack or from the Curated Questions homepage. Additionally, the homepage includes a link to record your right now question, which may be included in an upcoming episode. If you have found this show provides you value, please hit that subscribe button and leave a comment. Until I found myself on this side of the microphone, I didn't understand how much of a difference those actions actually do make. And that wraps up another episode. Drop in the comments section of your favorite podcast player the moments that will stick with you. To those on the other side of the speaker, thank you for being here. Gratitude shout out to Beauty Pill for the show's music and producer Ben Ford for the technical help. This episode was recorded on Piscataway land. Please engage with this episode in some manner. download, follow, save, like, share, or comment about something that resonated. This action ensures we are engaging the questioning community. Until next time, keep questioning.